Hello and welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast, a show where we bring you insights from media industry experts to help journalists do their jobs better. I'm your host, Jacob Granger. This week, we are talking about how journalists can channel their creative writing side by turning to the world of fiction. In 2019, Northern Irish journalist Leona O'Neill witnessed the murder of fellow journalist Lyra McKee in the streets of Cregan in Derry whilst covering the riots. That experience left Leona with PTSD and in need of counselling. She pivoted her career into academia while finding a positive release in book writing. She co-authored her first book in 2022 called Breaking, Trauma in the Newsroom, where she was amongst 16 journalists detailing how the profession has impacted their mental health. More recently, though, her writing career has taken a new direction. Next month, she will publish her first fiction book, Perdition Street, a supernatural story inspired by her own journey. What is it like then, as a journalist used to dealing in facts, not fiction, to veer into creative storytelling? Here's a hint. Journalists have a wealth of inspiration all around them every single day. That's all coming up, so don't go anywhere. Leona, welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast. Thank you ever so much for coming back onto our show.
Great to see you again, Jacob.
We're going to talk a lot today about writing from a position of pain in both creative ways and also, you know, more traditional ways as journalists. But in order to do that, we kind of need to go back 5 years to quite a difficult place to really fully appreciate the journey you've been on. We're talking here about Lyra McKee, who is a journalist, a peer of yours, who was murdered in the Cregan estate in Derry in 2019. You were there that night. What impact did that have on you, witnessing that?
Yeah, it had a monumental impact. It changed my life. It made me give up journalism, I suppose. It made me burn my journalism career to the ground and start again in academia. I can't even describe the impact that it had on my life. But it was, at the time, I suppose, to give some context, at the time I was a reporter for the Belfast Telegraph, which is a big newspaper, daily newspaper here in Northern Ireland. And I work for the radio too, so I was a freelancer at the time, so I was covering a couple of different places, but most of the time it was Belfast Telegraph. And there had been rioting in, as there tends to be in Northern Ireland. I've covered hundreds of riots over my career, 25 years covering this place. And there had been rioting, and I was called up to the scene to report on it. The riot had been going on for a couple of hours when I was standing up against a wall of a house, because this rioting had happened between Republican, dissident Republicans and the police. They were attacking the police, basically. So there were police vehicles everywhere, if you could picture the scene. And there were young people with masks throwing petrol bombs and fireworks and attacking the police. And this was in a housing estate where people lived. People stand at their gates and they were, you know, their children on their hip. And it was just a completely normal occurrence. Rioting happens quite a lot in Northern Ireland. So it's not anything out of the ordinary. It's not a big shock. There's almost like a carnival atmosphere at it. It's festival atmosphere. It's very, very strange for people looking in from outside. So I was standing, sort of leaning up against a garden wall, basically, and I was filing my story. It was coming up to 11 o'clock and our paper was going to print at 11, and I was just filing the last bits of my copy to Belfast when a gunman came around from the corner and fired shots up the street. And I knew immediately that it was gunfire. I've covered enough riots. I've covered enough, you know, funerals where they shoot guns, and I've heard gunfire before. I knew immediately that it was gunfire. So I ducked down and I ran, and I could hear bullets whizzing past my head. And I took hard cover behind a wall. And from there, I looked across and I saw what I initially thought was a bag. I don't know why I thought this, but I thought it was someone had dropped a bag of washing on the floor, on the ground beside the police Land Rover. And because it takes a while for your brain to register something so horrific. I don't know why I thought that, but then I saw a face and I saw that it was a young woman. And then people started to scream, her friends started to scream, and just all hell broke loose and the fireworks were still going. And I thought I could still hear shots. And you know, people tried their best to help that poor woman, poor young woman. She was only 29 years old, the start of her life, you know. And when you see something like that, it makes an imprint on your brain, on your soul. I was in shock for days afterwards. I didn't know what I was doing. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't concentrate. Just your brain shuts down whenever you see something so horrific. Not only seeing someone dying on the street there, but also the bullets whizzing by your head and thinking, what if one of those bullets that were very close because I could hear them had hit me? I wouldn't have come home to my children. It was awful. It was an awful, awful time. And when I look back at it now, I genuinely don't know how I got through it, because it was not only that, seeing something so horrific, so horrible. In the days afterwards, conspiracy theorists picked it up and they ran with it, and they said it was a false flag and that we were actors and that I had kidnapped Lyra and I was holding her hostage. All absolutely crazy stuff. But thousands of people were you know, in contact with me about that and coming through social media. And some of these conspiracy theorists, they have YouTube channels and they made videos, and I was getting horrific abuse. I was getting death threats. I was all this kind of stuff whilst also trying to deal with seeing someone being murdered. So I got PTSD from that.
Thank you for sharing that, Leona. I know it wasn't easy. But, you know, I hate to fast forward, but in the years that followed after that, I understand you had counselling and you came to terms with this in some way. How did you manage the PTSD over the years?
How did I manage it? For the first year, I was full reporter mode. I was totally ignore what's happening. I'm a reporter. These things happen all the time. This is part of the job. And I worked 24/7. And I realize now, looking back, that that was a trauma response. I was totally traumatized by that. What I had seen and what happened afterwards, the threats to me from people who had, you know, done this action, you know, killed this girl, and from other people, from conspiracy theorists, and the threats to my children, the threats to my home. I just kept going. I worked 24/7, and if I didn't, I worked all weekend, I worked all day, and I turned into a workaholic, and that's one of the symptoms, I suppose, of PTSD, which I didn't realize that I had at the time. You know, you get this mindset when you're a reporter, and I'm sure people listening will relate, that this is part of the job. You have to be hard-nosed. You have to be tough. If you're not tough, then go and do features or go and do sport or something like that. You can't obviously be a news reporter if you struggle with anything. So I struggled on. I wasn't sleeping. I was a total insomniac. I was going on 2 hours sleep a day, and I was having panic attacks daily. I was absolutely broken as a person and didn't seek any help with it. And then COVID arrived, you know, not too long afterwards. And I got COVID. I don't know if it was COVID because it was before we were testing, but I got really sick and I had to isolate because, you know, we're being told at that time you have to isolate from your family. There was no vaccine or anything then. And I had to isolate in a room by myself for a week. And my God, I thought and I processed and I tried to process anyway. And in the dark in my room by myself. And it was horrible because I was working and working and working, because when I stopped working, my brain would go back to that dark Craigan Street and the screaming and the crying and the fireworks, the horror of it all. And in that room, while I had COVID, that's where my brain went. I needed help in the middle of a pandemic, though, which was difficult. I reached out to a couple of really great journalism charities, and they set up some online counselling for me. And that was a godsend. That was me talking about this for the first time.
If I could then jump to 2022, and you co-authored the Breaking Trauma in the Newsroom book. That's a collection of stories, including your own, about the mental health aspect of working in journalism. How did you find that experience?
So when I was going through what I was going through, I thought I was by myself with these feelings. I thought I was the only person, the only journalist that was weak and struggled with this type of stuff. I think I said something online about being broken. The people, conspiracy theorists, were really having a field day with this, because I wasn't answering them back. I wasn't in a great place that I could answer them back or fight with them or argue with them. And I think I said something on Twitter. It was, right now I'm broken, but when I get back, you know, I was threatening them with legal action. it kind of gained momentum where people were sharing their stories with me. And then I would say, there's something in this. It's not just us. We formed a bit of a tribe of people who were kind of almost like a support group with one another. And then I started talking to people who had stories, you know, perhaps Chris Lindsay, who co-edited the book with me. I said to him one day, we have something here. There's a lot of people who don't want to talk about what happened to them in journalism, but there are a lot of people who do and they want to share their story. I think that this would be really good because I think when I started talking about it, more people gathered towards me. I think if we put this on a larger scale, it could be a really big thing, and we'll let people know that they're not alone, that there are other people out there, and it'll make people feel a bit better. So we gather stories from people, very well-known journalists, in Northern Ireland, in the UK, in England and Scotland and Wales as well, about their experiences. And a lot of them, it was the first time that they have ever spoken about this, but writing that and pulling that together and telling those stories was really therapeutic for me also.
I wonder if that openness has allowed you to do what's next, which is the Perdition Street book that's come out, you know, or will come out next month, should I say. Tell us about this, because, you know, my understanding is it's a similar motivation in terms of writing from pain, fueled by the PTSD that we've already spoken about, but
yeah,
it goes in a very different direction.
Yeah, this is a fiction book. This is a supernatural, dark supernatural fiction book. And I suppose when I was younger, I would always kind of lean into the likes of Stephen King or Anne Rice, or escape into those type of worlds. I was growing up in Northern Ireland and it wasn't a particularly nice place growing up, so there's a place to escape even if it was full of vampires or supernatural creatures. When I was really broken as a person, when I was going through that PTSD in the middle of a pandemic where you're totally isolated, I couldn't really see through the storm clouds at all. And, you know, the work wasn't, I was freelancing, work wasn't great because I was under threat from people. I was told that I couldn't go into certain areas, I would get beaten up, and the wolves were at the door. There was a lot of horrible people kind of coming at me at that time, and I kind of went into myself for a while, and then I thought, I'm going to lean into my creativity. I'm going to do what I can here to keep me afloat, to keep me going. And I started writing this book, and it's a book about a Dublin private detective who is a soul binder, and he binds the souls of the murdered to those who murdered them. So it's not a million miles away from the news. I'm sure many reporters know of stories of people who have been murdered and no one was ever held accountable for that murder. And I here in Northern Ireland in particular, there are a lot of families like that that I would have dealt with in the news, that who had their loved ones, their mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, husbands, wives, murdered by paramilitaries, murdered by terrorists, and who never got their day in court, who never got to see justice, who never got to see closure. And I could see how it ate them up. And also as a reporter, you're seeing stories of, you know, parents murdering their children and awful, awful stuff. And maybe no one being held to account for that as well, for the awfulness of that. So this guy binds the souls of the murdered to their murderer, and the soul drags the murderer to hell, and they're released then up to heaven. And if I can paint a picture for you, he's a very flawed character. He's a lot of anxiety. He's got depression. He has his own trauma issues. He's got alcohol problems, but he's also, and he's very prone to violence. But he makes these bad guys pay in really brutal ways. And I suppose when I was, you know, in the midst of PTSD, not only because of seeing someone being murdered myself in front of my eyes, but all the stories that went before that of men being shot, fathers being shot at their front door in front of their children by paramilitaries, or people being shot dead on the street or blown up or whatever. Those stories came back to haunt me as well a lot of the time. And I created this character when I was completely broken as a person, completely broken. I can't even describe. I created this character who was strong, who made bad guys pay, who, you know, people who hurt people, he made them pay by hurting them, I suppose.
Like a supernatural vigilante of sorts.
Yeah. That's kind of what he is, yeah.
Yeah. So because you've seen so much injustice in your journalism career, this was a way of, at least in your mind, trying to put that to right in some way.
Absolutely. I was saying at the time when I was writing it, and when I was writing it, I was really going through it with PTSD. I couldn't sleep. So I would wake up in the middle of the night with nightmares and insomnia and everything else. And I would, instead of, you know, pacing the floors and worrying about things or whatever, I would write. And I always say that this character, Atlas Bishop, who's the main character in the book, that he would not let me have peace until I got him out of my head and onto the paper and allowed him to exercise the demons that were haunting me for quite a long time. Even before, as I saw Lear McKeeben murdered, there were all our horrific, one of them stands out with me. I remember a woman from my own home city here, her husband was kidnapped and tied, chained to his van with a bomb in it. And her family were held at gunpoint, and he was forced to drive the van full of explosives to an army, British Army checkpoint where the IRA exploded it. Nobody was ever held to account for that. Nobody ever saw inside of a courtroom or inside of a jail cell. And that woman said to me, and which was a common thread with all of these people, I could be walking past my husband's killer in the street. I could be meeting him in the grocery store and saying hello to him, and I wouldn't know. These faceless people who murdered other human beings and got away with it. I think that was this Atlas Bishop guy, my main character, helped to exorcise those demons, because it was a sense of injustice, a sense of how can people do this to one another and then just get on with their lives and everything's fine. Well, this guy, Atlas Bishop, says it's not fine, and he went and got them dragged to hell, which was where they belong. So
what does Atlas Bishop represent to you?
Justice and perseverance and determination, even when you're absolutely broken, because Atlas Bishop is a flawed individual as well as myself, a flawed individual with some trauma issues and anxiety. And I've given him some of my stuff. I talk about panic attacks. He has panic attacks in the book. And I've given him some of my traits. But he represents justice. Yeah, people, if the human realm cannot provide justice for these families that have lost loved ones and their lives completely stopped and they were consumed by this awfulness of losing their loved one in such a brutal way, then perhaps the other realm can serve that justice in a more eternal way, in a way that's more deserving, I suppose, of people who think that they're getting away with murdering folks.
Tell me if I'm wrong here, but it sounds to me like you identify a little bit with this protagonist, and you put quite a lot of yourself in it in terms of being the journalist or the legal system that is, you know, putting justice right.
Yeah, I do. As I say, I give him some of my quirks. Obviously, he's a guy. He's very violent. I'm the opposite of that. I'm a complete pacifist.
I get that.
I chase flies around the house so that I don't hit them with anything and kill them. I make sure that they get out. I don't kill spiders. Certainly wouldn't kill another human being. So I do relate with him. I do relate with, I can relate with people who are flawed and who are broken. And this guy certainly is in the book. This is not a reflection of my own family, but his father murdered his mother, so the ghost of his mother kind of follows him around. But yeah, I do. There's things that are completely away from me, but I did give him my anxiety when I'm talking about the panic attacks. Some of the time I was writing the sort of descriptive language about a panic attack while I was also having a panic attack in the middle of the night. So Atlas Bishop was running around saving all these souls in Dublin and beyond, and saving the world, but it also saved me a bit too, because I was able to lean into him when I wasn't strong and create this fictional character that just absolutely kicks ass.
Sounds like he does. But this has helped you, right? Coming to the end of this book, seeing it in printed form, can you definitively say that this has helped you, this experience?
Yeah, it absolutely has. As I say, whenever people who are creative, like me, I'm very creative. I'm always, I find writing very, very therapeutic. Sometimes I find it easier to put things down on words than to speak. I'm getting better at the actual speaking part now, but sometimes I find it easier to put my feelings down on a, you know, on a news article, or instead of speaking them out loud, sometimes your emotion kind of strangles you. It helped me looking back now, because I realized I was so, so broken as a person, as a human being, but I was still able to create something. I was still able to work through that kind of storm that was raging all around me and produce something that was good and that people like. And not that I need kind of valediction for anybody to tell me that that something is good, but the fact that I sometimes think that I'm not strong. I sometimes think that I still have that sort of reporter's mindset. Oh, you know, you're weak because you did this, or you're not up to it because you did this. I look back at how broken I was and how absolutely just, I was floored by this. I was still able to produce something. I was still able to create. I was still able to have some kind of light in all of that darkness. And that kind of is the best. And when I look at that book, that's what I see. I see someone who was broken, but flipping did it anyway, and didn't lie down underneath this, and produce something that hopefully people will maybe could relate to, or, you know, lean into themselves. That Atlas's strength, despite the fact that he is also a broken person.
I think that's remarkable. I mean, what I want to ask you, and I'm going to try and be really sensitive about this, is how recommended is it to go down this path of writing from such a position of pain? I mean, did you get a professional opinion before going down this road and exploring and going into any of this?
No, no, I didn't. I just did it. I don't know what it was. Perhaps it was organic. Perhaps it's the only way that I knew. Perhaps it's, you know, I've always written. I've always used writing as a therapy, where I, you know, I keep a journal. I would write down my feelings there, as opposed to telling them to people or being so open about things. A few years back, I did a TED talk in Stormont in front of 300 people. And as I say, whenever we're reporters, we're told not to be the story, not to be part. Don't make the story part of you. You're not part of it. You're not important. And almost dehumanizing us as reporters. And I was just like, no, I'm a human being too. I'm a member of this citizenship of the world. And what I have to say is important as well. So I will stand up here and I will talk about journalism, or I will stand up here and I will talk about what happened to me, because I'm important too. It's not just, you know, all the news stories in the world. I'm also important in this whole sort of situation. I mean, my counsellor at the time, who's fantastic, said, do whatever it is that makes you feel better. Do whatever it is that makes you feel at peace. And so I just did that. I didn't tell her I was writing a book about about supernatural private detectives or anything like that. But I, she said, like, everybody finds their thing. Find your thing, whatever it is that makes you feel good. Whatever, when you're going through that storm, if there's anything at all that you can see light from, walk towards that. That's where you need to go. But it has helped me so much, this whole process. It has helped me put, put things down on paper, but also talk about stuff and other people. It lands with people, and people contact me all the time about, you know, this is great what you've done, and I'm going to do the same thing. And that's what makes it worthwhile, I think.
Does it change, being on the other side of this now, does it change how you feel about what happened in 2019?
No, honestly, it doesn't change. That will always be there. That will always be, I suppose, it's not a stain on my soul. There is no escaping that, absolutely no escaping that. And I think about that regularly. I think about that night, and I think about the weeks afterwards. I think about it all the time. And because it was such a worldwide event, I'm reminded of it. There's literally no escape from it, none at all. You know, you switch on social media, and sometimes maybe there's been something happening in the court case, and poor Lyra McKee's face is there, and on your social media, just, you know, there whenever you're just scrolling through, maybe at lunchtime, or anniversaries come up. There's literally no escape from it. So I will never make peace with the people who did that awful. But Yeah, it doesn't change how I feel about what happened that night. No, it doesn't. It was an awful, awful experience, which destroyed my life, destroyed my career, destroyed my mental health. I used to be I have used what happened afterwards, leaning into my creativity to build myself back up again. It's almost like learning to walk again. It's awful. So before Lear McKee was murdered, I used to stand up in front of 1,500 people and talk, and I was so confident and I was so sure of myself. And after it happened, I couldn't even get the words out, you know, in the years after, I couldn't even get the words out to tell people what happened that night. My emotions would strangle it. And I pushed myself to do that TED talk, even though I felt sick doing it. And I felt, you know, talking about that experience and talking about journalism, talking about mental health in front of 200 people. I felt sick doing that, but I did it because I thought, right, I've done that now. Right, what's next? What's next? What's next? Keep pushing and pushing and pushing yourself. And doing this book is kind of the ultimate thing. I'm putting myself out there. I'm talking about my own struggles, reflecting off Atlas Bishop's problems. And it's a process, but it doesn't change how I think about that night. I still have nightmares about that night, and that it will be with me forever and ever, like a black specter walking beside me constantly.
But part of you feels healed. That's what I kind of take from this. At least there's some sort of acceptance, and you've found some of your confidence back. You've still been able to tap into your writing. There's part of you has come away from these experiences healed.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, I'm not having panic attacks every day. I feel stronger. I feel more able to talk about these type of things. I feel more able to talk about that night. And yeah, healed in a way. But it's not linear. Healing is not linear. You know, you go and you think that you're doing okay, and then maybe something reminds you. Maybe you see someone on the street who maybe was threatening towards you. Or it's really odd to me now at the minute, where people are so supportive and they're saying, this is fantastic and you've done this fantastic book. And I'm like, this is kind of strange, because I'm almost having to flip my own mindset into thinking good things can happen to me too. It's not all bad. You know, because for a time there was, you know, something bad happened, then something else bad happened, then another 10 bad things happened. And now it's kind of like, this is a good thing has happened. And then there's another good thing has happened. Oh, hold on. When is the bad thing hurtling down the track at me? When it's going to hit me soon. So I need to brace for this. So I almost need to change my own mindset to kind of get around thinking that good things can also happen to me.
Remarkable. So, As we think about wrapping up here, I mean, you've kind of played for both sides here a little bit. You've done the factual writing, you've done fiction writing, you've done creative writing, you've done news writing. Was it hard to tap into the creative side in terms of swapping the facts out for fiction and going into that kind of space?
If I look back now at some of the fiction stories that I wrote 10, 15 years ago, they're just new extended features. They're just news stories extended. And the style of writing is very different. It's different moving from that style, new style, the features, to fiction writing. It's a completely different style of writing. It's a completely different style of thinking and pulling stuff together and story arcs and making characters, building characters and building worlds and all this type of stuff that you don't have to think about whenever you're writing news or features. It's very different. It's more difficult, but I find it more enjoyable as well. I find it's, you can escape into these worlds that you're building. And I always think Perdition Street is sometimes a bit scary, a bit frightening, a bit sort of, there's a sort of wee bit of horror in it, but it's horror that I'm controlling and I don't get scared by it because I'm able to control these characters, what they do. There's no surprises. There's no kind of stress. I'm controlling exactly what they do. So in that way, it's good. So, but it's a completely different style of writing. It's
Do they have anything in common?
No, I don't think they do. I mean, storytelling.
We talk about stories and we talk about storytelling, so I just wonder,
yeah,
are there any commonalities?
There perhaps the story, you know, you have to, when you're writing features, I wrote features for such a long time as well, for years and years, you have to have something that engages your audience, and it's the same with fiction. So in that way, perhaps they're the same, But with stories and features, you're writing from real life. People are giving you their stuff to write about. People are giving you their experiences and their quirks and what they have done and the extraordinary things that have happened to them. And you're shaping that into a story that engages the public. But with fiction, you have to think up the extraordinary things. And certainly, I suppose, when I was writing this story, there's a couple of the fiction story, sorry, Perdition Street, there are a couple of incidents in there that I give to Atlas Bishop that actually happened in real life. I'll not say what they were, but, you know, murder stories and things that happened to people. I took some of the information from that and I kind of built, you know, a scenario that Atlas Bishop could kind of exist in. You really have to think about fiction, and you're not just dealing with a whole lot of facts and forming them together into a really good feature. You have to dream up the facts first. You have to dream up the fiction first, dream up the scenarios, and it all has to flow very well in the same way that I suppose a news feature has to flow well, but on a bigger scale. I mean, Perdition Street is, I think it's 92,000 words. A feature's what, 3,000 words? It's
never going to complain about an 800 word feature again.
Never complain about it again. But it's and I just finished the second book actually there. I sent it to my agent. I have an agent in London about witches this time. It's about Irish witches, and it's, I think it's 93,000 words. So yeah, I'm a bit of a writing machine at the minute. But
your keyboard must be knackered.
Yeah, I am too. But no, I do. I mean, I always said years and years ago, there's an old editor of mine that said there's a book in every single journalist. And I was like, well, I think I have three in me. I've got them out there now. But whenever you're gifted with the writing and the storytelling, it's not easy to transfer over to kind of fiction writing, but it's not also, it wouldn't be as difficult for someone who had no grasp of writing or grasp of storytelling. It's easier for journalists to do that. So everybody, write your book. There's a book in you. Get it out there now.
You touched on something actually very interesting, because we are used to much more condensed forms of writing as journalists. A book is a whole other different scale. What's your one piece of advice for scaling up, you know, an idea up to a book? What helped you?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's just you write with fire and you edit with ice. So I just basically...
Oh, that was a hell of a soundbite. Wow.
Write with fire and edit with ice. I think it was an old editor of mine told me that as well, this very wise man I once knew. But you have an idea in your head. I always write the book that I want to read. I'm very particular about books. I like books that have a bit of action in them. I like books that are urban fantasy, that kind of have real life mixed with you know, magical kind of worlds. And I suppose that really leans into reporting as well, where you see the underbelly of a city whenever you're a reporter that other people don't see. And it's not a magical world by any means or any stretch of the imagination. It's courts and it's horribleness, and it's gone out to really horrible stories. And then you have ordinary real life here. So I think that's maybe a bit of that, a reflection of that. But scaling it up, I don't know, think of if you have a character in your head, and I'm sure a lot of people do, they have a story that they really want to tell, or they have a character, just allow them to develop. And I would get notebooks. I would go and buy a notebook. This was my kind of process. Go and buy a notebook in the Range or whatever, a pen. And I would go and sit in a coffee shop and I would people watch. And I would start to write down notes. And this person, this character would just form in your head. And then you build on that. Well, what adventures are you going to send them on? What are you going to do? You need to add tension to that. You need to add tension to whatever's going to happen to them. Are they going to save the world? Are they just going to save themselves? Or what is it that they're going to do? And I have notebooks. Genuinely, I have about 10 notebooks full of just scribbles. It's nobody can read it except me. It's like a beautiful mind type of thing, just scribbling and scribbling. And but it helps you form what's going to go in your head. But reporters know people, and that's a really good recipe for a good story as well. How people work, how people think, how people act in various situations and scenarios. And you can really bring a character to life whenever you add those, not steal them, borrow kind of quirks from people, you know, lend those to characters, and you've got fully fledged, proper fleshy characters right in front of you, and they have human responses and they have really deep and profound character in front of you. Before you know it, just absolutely let your imagination run wild. That's what I would say. That would be the best advice.
That's awesome advice. You know, I just feel like running to my nearest coffee shop right now.
Whenever you have an experience, like you're standing on a road and there are bullets flying past your head and you could have died, you didn't die, thankfully, but you saw someone else die and you went through this awful experience where you see just how fragile life is and how you can be here one minute and not here the next heartbeat. It makes me want to grab life by the scruff of the neck and just really shake every fiber out of it. You're only here once. You're not here for long. You could be gone tomorrow. Who knows? I want to justify my existence and I want my life here to have mattered. Obviously, it does to my family and stuff, but I want to do something with this life that I've been given. It's very fragile. It's very precious. And some people don't get to live as far as 48, as we saw with Lyra McKee. And I want to do something with it. So
you're not going to find a more empowering call to sort of seize the opportunity than that, Leona. So thank you ever so much for that and for chatting to me today. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jacob.
My takeaway for today is that final call to action. If you've got an idea, don't let it go to waste. Ultimately, it doesn't really matter if we're talking about books or another medium. There are many creative ways of dealing with the hardships of this job, writing being one of them, and you might just find being a journalist provides many advantages. Fiction writing might be a totally different world to news reporting, but the stories we cover, the humans we meet, the events we bear witness to, can all be powerful inspiration. I'd love to know what else you took from today's conversation. Find me on LinkedIn, Twitter/x@jpgjournalism, or email me on jacob@journalism.co.uk. You can check out all of our episodes on all your usual podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just search and subscribe to the journalism.co.uk podcast. But that's all we have time for this week. I've been your host, Jacob Granger. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.